investment bankers and admissions experts, Madeline Baker and Madeline Wang. Investment banking and admissions defines the experience of two accepted consultants, Madeline Baker and Madeline Wang. I'm going to pick their brains on this show. Welcome to the 227th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, Accepted's podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a stand out in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in," and not only in, but in at the best program for you. About a year ago, I received an email from someone interested in working for Accepted. She had admissions office experience, an MBA from a top business school, and investment banking experience on Wall Street and in Hong Kong. About a week later, I received another email from another potential consultant who attended a different top MBA program, but also had admissions office experience, an MBA from a top business school, and had worked in investment banking in both Wall Street and Hong Kong. And their first name was the same, though spelled slightly differently. They both joined Accepted and have been doing an outstanding job for our clients ever since. Madeline Baker and Madeline Wang, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Linda.
Okay. Delighted to have you both here. Delighted to have you both on the staff. I'd like to have each of you tell us a little bit about your backgrounds prior to joining Accepted. Madeline Baker, why don't you start?
Sure. Thank you for having me today, Linda. My first experience really working in MBA admissions goes back to 2002. I was working for MIT Sloan MBA admissions and really enjoyed my work there and, was working on the team with Mr. Rod Garcia. And after that, after I've been working for him for 2 years, I decided, well, it's really time for me to go back to business school and get my own MBA. And that's how I ended up at Columbia Business School. And I graduated from the school in 2006 and decided that after graduating from school, I wanted to be a banker on Wall Street and worked on Wall Street for about 10 years on and off in New York and Hong Kong, basically, really doing financial work in investment banking, corporate banking. And that became old after a while. 10 years, a long time on Wall Street. And I decided that I didn't want to be a banker anymore. And throughout my time at Columbia Business School, I was always involved in admissions with interviewing candidates and providing feedback to the office. So when I decided that I didn't want to be a banker anymore, I contacted Yale School of Management and worked as an outside reader for them for about 2 years. And that's when I came in contact with you. And I've been on the Accepted staff for the past year.
So after leaving Yale, you joined Accepted. Well, we're happy to have you. Madeline Wang, what's your background?
My background is after my undergrad, I worked in investment banking in New York and in Hong Kong before going to business school. And while I was at business school at Wharton, I decided that I wanted to take on a part-time job working as a graduate student member of the admissions committee. And I really enjoyed it. I would read a stack of 20 applications every week and provide my recommendations on those applications to the admissions committee. And it was a really great part of my experience while I was at Wharton. And after I graduated, I worked professionally in management consulting and then went back into finance for several years. But during that period, I was an active Wharton alum as an interviewer and in other capacities. And I also worked a lot with people in my firm who were either on my team or elsewhere in my company who were applying to business schools and kind of worked as a mentor more informally with them and wrote recommendations, if I was their manager, and really loved that process as something I did on the side for many years. But over the past few years, I really decided to take my work in a different direction and do work really more on a more flexible basis and that I really have always enjoyed all these years. And really, that's why, you know, I decided to join Accepted.
Okay, great. Wow, there's a lot of questions going in my head now, but let's start with this next one. You both spent a lot of time in financial services. What are the critical qualities that investment banks and top financial services companies look for in job applicants? Obviously, you worked in admissions, but I'm wondering from a financial services perspective, not so much an admissions perspective, what are they looking for?
This is Madeline Wang. I'll
okay.
take that.
Okay.
I would say in terms of, you know, being at an investment bank and hiring applicants, the first thing that I would really look for is really kind of strong quantitative skills and horsepower. And so that, you know, from a resume perspective can be, you know, through looking at your statistics, like your grades and, you know, your GMAT, especially, you know, your quantitative score, you know, courses that you've taken, your work experience to that, whether your past experience has really shown, you know, strong quantitative requirements and ability in your past. And then from a personal perspective, I would say we looked for people who were very hard workers. Because as you know, the investment banking career can be very demanding in terms of hours, and also just a certain drive and I would say kind of toughness, if you will, or resilience, if you will, because it's a pretty demanding work environment. And so looking for someone who really wants to be there and willing to put in the work to do what it takes to succeed.
Madeline Baker, do you have anything you want to add? That answer?
Yeah, I think that was a great summary. I would also add, you know, throughout my experience, I think smart, motivated candidates that have the grit and determination to succeed in this industry that's really extremely, like Madeline Wang said, extremely demanding, and you want to make sure that you want to put those hours in. And one of the attributes that business schools are looking for, and I think that's also very dominant in the financial industry, is somebody who's willing to play well on a team. Like, you might be a really good quant person, but you also have the ability to act well on a team and to interact with others. You're going to interact with people in the financial industry. You're going to interact with people with legal lawyers outside of your firm. And you have to want to be able to be motivated and be a team player and have grit and determination to make it through this career that's extremely demanding, and that's what always I wanted to see when I was hiring junior people, and I think that's what business schools want to see. They want somebody with endurance.
That was actually going to be my next question, is do you see business schools looking for the same qualities that financial service firms look for? And Madeline Wang, I was going to ask you about consulting firms also. But Madeline Baker, since you kind of raised that point, do you want to be the first to respond on that one?
Yeah, absolutely, I would say. So business schools are looking for the very same, or often not the very same, but very similar qualities. So quant skills is sort of like something that'll get you in the door, but it won't be enough. So you're going to have to show that you're also a team player and that you have determination to succeed. Like a lot of candidates, I think these days what I see sometimes or once in a while is people that in the newer generation are switching and jobs very often and hopping around in jobs. And that's something that, for example, for business schools, a little bit concerning because, on the one hand, this is great. Candidates are exploring different careers. They also want to see that somebody has longevity and that they're willing to stick with something and willing to succeed and not just letting things drop at the very, you know, first sign of resistance or hardship in a job. So I would say the qualities are very similar for financial services as well as, you know, what MBA schools are looking for, top schools.
Okay. Madeline Wang, do you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, I do think that there are some qualities that are the same, exactly as Madeline Baker was saying, in terms of really the, the being smart and having perseverance. But when you're talking about building a class for business school, I think there's also a lot of other things that you would look at, because you're really trying to build, a very, diverse group of people who can really teach each other, and create an interesting community. So, obviously that means you're going to have plenty of people who don't have science backgrounds, or, didn't necessarily work in a quantitative field, but have, very interesting experiences and other skills like leadership, and, are very strong team players, and have, a diverse range of interests. And certainly, that doesn't necessarily factor in when, you're hiring someone to be, to be a financial analyst in an investment bank. It's not as important. But when you're building a business school class, having a really diverse range of people and interests is, I think, critically important.
Right. And Madeline Wang, I wanted to ask you, and you also worked for Bain and were, you were in management consulting. Were the criteria somewhat different for management consulting than, let's say, in financial services? And obviously we're talking in broad categories.
Yeah, I think that there's certainly, there's always some similarities just in terms of really wanting to have very high caliber, smart candidates come in. But I would say for consulting, there's more diversity in the backgrounds of people who go into consulting. And so you need to have quantitative skills, but you don't necessarily, it's not necessarily as important to have a strong quantitative experience or background to point to. In consulting, the value is much more on problem solving and critical thinking. And a lot of that comes out in the case interviews, which consulting firms use. So it's a little bit of a different dynamic. And there's also a strong emphasis on having someone who presents very well, because there's so much day-to-day client interaction. And so being able to be someone that a senior partner would be comfortable putting you in front of a client by yourself is very important. And so the presentation aspect is highly valued as well.
Okay. And do you think, or in your experience, do you know really that schools, when clients say, I want to go into consulting, or I want to go into financial services, investment banking, private equity, whatever, are schools already kind of looking for the qualities that those specific prospective employers will look for in the candidate? Or are they just looking more broadly for the qualities that employers in general like? Madeline Wang, why don't you go first on this one?
I would say that in looking at an applicant, when I would look at what they said they wanted to do after business school, you want to make sure that what they're saying makes sense. And that that looks like a, kind of a logical and realistic path for them. And so I think implicit in that would be, do they look like they would have the skills to really make that happen? It's a little bit less explicit and more maybe implicit in that review. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I would say that in business school, even despite your best laid intentions, people a lot of times really discover new paths or new interests. And so more broadly, I think, an admissions application, I'd really be looking for someone, who I think, do I think that they have the qualities to be, successful in business, post MBA. And so it's not necessarily so specific to one path that they might have laid out in their application.
Right. Also, people, let's face it, people change their paths. They change their paths in business school, after business school. People go from consulting to finance, like you did. Some people, they do different things. So, all right, that makes sense. Madeline Baker, do you have anything to add to that one?
Yeah, I would just add to that's true. And I think that schools understand that, you know, people enter business school and they might change their mind on what they ultimately want to do. But I do believe that the schools look closely at what the goals are that somebody outlines, what their professional goals are and what applicants outline in the application, with the ultimate goal of them being realistic and being achievable, especially for career switches, for example. Schools look at applicants and, you know, decide from a career services perspective if the applicant's able to, if that goal is realistic and achievable, because they take great pride in, you know, in finding jobs for the MBA students, and they want to make sure that they're able to actually achieve what they're setting themselves up to do.
Okay, great. Now, you both worked in Hong Kong at different points in time. What are the elements of the admissions process that Asians tend to be unaware of or to underestimate? Madeline Baker, why don't you start with that one?
That's a great question. I love my time in Hong Kong, and I think there are a lot of great applicants coming from Asia. I think, broadly speaking, the sheer number of applications that are coming out of Asia is just so much larger compared to the seats available for candidates from these regions. As we previously spoke, you know, the schools are trying to put a diverse class together, but, you know, they can only give a certain percentage, and that's not necessarily predetermined, but they can't give an overwhelmingly high percentage to Asian applicants. So there's a little bit of a disadvantage just because there's so many applications coming from Asia, and the GMAT scores from Asia tend to be higher, so that applicants from Asia compete with much higher GMAT scores and just have to make sure that they're not just aiming to stand out in the application process through a high GMAT score. And that's, I think, something that Asian candidates underestimate, where they, you know, they apply to a school and they get an incredibly high score and incredibly high GPA and assume that based on those stats, they'll be able to get into school. That's not necessarily the case. So they really need to consider putting a unique story together in applying to business school and telling a very different story to the admissions office as they, why they should have a place in the class. So that's one thing. And I think from a recommendation standpoint, ADCOM typically knows that recommendation letters from different countries will look differently. So that's not typically a huge issue, but there is such a thing as, you know, being very modest in Asia and not boasting so much with showing off skills and stuff like that. Those are little nuances that can vastly improve chances of admission if candidates really focus in on that and work with somebody who's seen that a lot.
Okay. Madeline Wang, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Not really. I mean, I think that that was an excellent answer from Madeline Baker, and I would echo those thoughts. I was, you know, really, it's the need to have a kind of a diverse application that doesn't simply rely on your stats, your GMAT, your grades as kind of the reason for admission, and absolutely being able to present yourself in a way that really highlights your achievements without being overly modest, and also to make sure that you're really adequately emphasizing some of the personal elements that might make you stand out beyond what, you know, what your GPA or your scores, you know, might tell you, or even, you know, your job description. So there has to be, or hopefully there is something outside of work where, you know, you have strong interests, you know, and or leadership. That's also important, and something that I think some Asian applicants maybe don't realize as they approach the process.
Right. That's, to me, the biggest difference with the Asian applicants is that they tend to focus way too much or exclusively on stats.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I also want to ask, Madeline Baker, you worked in the admissions office first, and then you applied to business school. So you were probably a very, very savvy applicant. But
I think so. Unfortunately, yes. I worked in at MIT Sloan for 2 years and then decided to go to business school. So I would assume I had a little bit of a leg up there.
Yeah, in terms of insight. But Madeline Wang, you applied. You didn't have that admissions experience. I mean, you know, I think you went to Stanford undergrad. You obviously, you worked in investment banking, but you didn't have the kind of inside the office experience and only got mm-hmm. that, I think, in your second year at Wharton, right? Am I correct on that?
Right. That's right. That's right.
What surprised you working on the other side as in the admissions office?
I would say that it was actually really, really eye-opening and in a very positive way, to just see the sheer diversity of backgrounds of people who apply to and go to business school. And obviously as a student, you know, I experienced it, but in a very kind of condensed way, when you're reading applications, you know, if you're sitting down and you know, kind of going through 20 applications, you're getting like these people's life stories shared with you, and so the diversity of backgrounds was something I really learned from reading the applications and kind of being a part of the process, understanding how much that was valued. I mean, Wharton is a very is very known for having a strong finance program, but there's a huge diversity in terms of, you know, other offerings by the school, as well as, you know, the people's backgrounds and their career objectives. So that was something that was really, you know, surprising to me in a positive way. I was also, I guess, struck by, if I were to think about some negatives that surprised me, especially as someone who's very detail oriented myself, is just, you know, I felt like there were applications that weren't proofed, you know, when they came in, and just seeing these errors, like, really just was for me, you know, an immediate turnoff that, you know, really just kind of a careful proofreading would have caught, errors from a native English speaker, or, you know, not putting, you know, not having replaced, you know, another school's name, you know, in your application that, you know, you copy the essay from. So things like that seemed to me just very easy things that applicants could have addressed. And it was really a shame because they would really kind of get dismissed right away.
Okay. Yeah. That's very good to know and keep in mind for applicants that sloppiness counts or hurts is really what it does. Now,
right.
How has your perspective on the admissions process changed since you became a consultant and are now helping applicants? Madeline Baker, why don't you start with that one?
Yeah, I would say that's an interesting question, Linda, because I think my perspective has changed tremendously. You know, I remember sitting, not at Yale, but reading Yale applications, hundreds of them. And when you do that, you really, you forget about how much work goes into these applications, how much you really have to think about how you're presenting yourself. Because while you're on the reader's side, you're just, you know, focused on reading through these documents, and you really don't appreciate how much work has to go into that to produce this full picture that we work on with our applicants and on putting together very thoughtfully. And I think to me that has completely, you know, realigned myself and straightened myself out. And, you know, it's easy to say, and I've seen enough sloppy applications, you know, across the board in all the admissions offices I've worked at, because it just happens, you know, applicants are in a hurry and they submit it. But you don't realize how much work goes into them, how many hours it takes, and how hard people work on it. And so to me, that was the biggest eye-opening experience, I think.
Okay. That's an interesting one. Yeah, that you suddenly realized how much time people take and what you maybe read in 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah,
right?
And it's easy. You sit there and you say, oh, he's writing, you know, like, it's very easy to be dismissive, or you put it into a certain category. And now I think my appreciation for putting it together and the work that goes into it is completely different.
Okay. Madeline Wang?
I have, post-MBA, I mean, I'd worked with applicants, you know, on their applications even before I joined Accepted. So, you know, I guess I would really contrast it as how did I feel as being when I was at school as a graduate student member of the admissions committee versus, you know, really kind of post-MBA. But I would say that I really realized how much being able to write, you know, reasonably well matters. And you know, as a member on the, you know, admissions committee who's reading applications, you just see what gets presented to you. And so to you, that's really the full picture of the candidate. And so if they left something out or didn't write something clearly or that well enough, I mean, that's all the information you have to go on. And so, you know, you just have to make quick judgments based on that. But, you know, as a consultant, I realize, especially as I, you know, maybe look at first drafts that people have submitted to me and then later on get to know them better, how much of a difference it can make to be able to tell your story well and to bring out, you know, elements that maybe you didn't quite realize, you know, matters a lot in an application. And to be able to really present yourself well really gives you a much better chance when you're applying.
At the AGAC conference this past summer, Haas was one of the host schools, and they have this thing called the Story Salon. And they had like a mini story salon for us. And in the story salon, they had like 5 or 6 students and alumni present their story. They had, you know, a few minutes to do so. And it was so impressive because they did it so well. They had classes on mm-hmm. how to tell their story. And mm-hmm. now obviously these were the ones who got in. So presumably there was some storytelling ability to begin with. But it was really, really impressive. That is just a terribly important skill.
Right.
And I think it's, well, obviously at Haas it's valued because it's taught, but I think it's also one that tends to be underestimated. And that's one of the things that obviously we help with when we work with clients. Now you know, between the four of you, the two of you, you've experienced 4 different schools, right? So Madeline Wang, you were at Wharton both as a student and as an application reader. Madeline Baker, you were on the admissions committee at MIT Sloan. You attended Columbia Business School, got your MBA there, and I believe also volunteered in the Hermes Society. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Right? And then you were an application reader at Yale. What would you say about the different cultures of these programs? Madeline Wang, why don't we start with you?
Well, for Wharton, as I was mentioning earlier, I mean, I think it's well known to be strong in finance and you know, and it certainly is. But at the same time, as one of the larger business school classes out there, one of the largest business school programs out there, it's definitely got a huge amount of diversity, you know, in terms of students and just the sheer offerings of classes and electives that you can take or other programs even outside of you know, the academic coursework, you know, kind of recruiting as well. You know, I mean, like, you know, every, you know, kind of major recruiter would really come to Wharton. And so I think just the size of it, allows it to have, a really great, kind of great set of resources that are available to students. And I think that was really, you know, a huge benefit to being part of that program. And then subsequently kind of a very large alumni network. I also really felt like the school was very collaborative and teamwork focused, probably more so than I might have expected. There was, you know, maybe just because it has a little bit more of a finance reputation, I possibly underestimated the amount of kind of the amount that teamwork and really, you know, helping each other and helping each other grow was really valued. And so I found it to be not at all kind of a competitive environment among the students. You know, people help each other, whether it's in work or in recruiting or, you know, anything else. It was just a very, very kind of friendly, open environment. And I guess the final thing I would say about Wharton, I felt like the program is one that is constantly improving itself. I felt like it was very responsive to student feedback and, you know, and constantly coming up with new ideas for, you know, for programs and, you know, responses to student feedback about courses if something wasn't working right. All of that really kind of made it a very dynamic program, I would say. And so I had an outstanding experience and, you know, only speak very highly of it.
Okay, great. The responsiveness, the commitment of the administration to respond to students' suggestions and needs was something that came through loud and clear, both at the recent AGET conference, which was on the West Coast, and at an earlier one in Philadelphia, which was hosted at Wharton. Something that really struck me.
Yeah, I would strongly agree with that.
Okay. Madeline Baker, you have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I have a lot to talk about. But so my first experience at MIT Sloan, that's a while ago now, so that was in 2002. But I remember this community being extremely tight-knit, extremely smart. Of course, all the business schools have smart students, but I just, when I was there, extremely smart, highly energetic. The students are involved in so many clubs, and they're organizing so many events. One of the favorites that I remember that even faculty went to were the C functions every Thursday. They were organized by a different club. And it's definitely a very collaborative environment. The people who were at MIT Sloan, for me, they were doers. They were always doing something, organizing something. They weren't just, you know, it's like sometimes you have the misperception that you're looking at nerds and they're just sitting in front of spreadsheets. That's not the case. They're really doing things. They're working together, and it's one of the smaller business schools. So it's a very tight-knit, nice community. So now that compares very differently to Columbia Business School, where I was a student and I was also involved in interviewing candidates for admissions. You know, Columbia Business School being part of the greater New York City is just a much larger school, and I was actually also involved in peer advising students, the incoming new students, and it just is big emphasis on teamwork. It has an excellent alumni network. The alumni network is instrumental also in, for example, organizing treks downtown, not the network itself, but the access to alumni is to organize treks to just any major company you can probably think of in New York City, because you're going to have a Columbia Business School alumni at that company. A nice way in which Columbia breaks down like the big student body is through the cluster system and peer advisors. So by breaking down, you know, into, I think it must be groups of 60 to 100 students, it becomes, you get like smaller pods within a bigger community because the overall size is relatively large. And then another thing that stood out for me at Columbia Business School while I was there was the Women Network. I would say it was probably one of the strongest women networks I've ever seen. And the men on campus always joke that the women are in charge at Columbia Business School, and that certainly sometimes felt that way. So it's an extremely strong network of women at Columbia. Now, moving to Yale, I think, so Yale is completely different because it's located in New Haven, and I was not involved as deeply in the student community. I was reading applications for the admissions office, but it's it's a lot of people focused on bettering the world, and it's very collaborative, it's very international, and there are business leaders from all over the world coming to Yale and speaking, and it's a big emphasis on teamwork at the school. So all very different schools, I would say.
Okay. When you were a reader for Yale, were you looking at all at the Yale videos, or was that after you left?
Yes, and that was actually that. As you were speaking about the ability to write, I was actually thinking in my head that I really like the ability for a lot of students or applicants hate doing the videos, but it really is such a great tool for you to showcase who you are. If you practice it enough, and you have the ability to really paint another picture for the admissions office, and watching those videos was incredibly
revealing,
mind opening. It was revealing because so different readers would approach it in different ways. So some readers would watch the video first and then read the application. I was more on the side of I would read the application front to back. And step away from it and make up my mind and provide scores on the application and then turn myself over to the video. And more every once in a while, you would get really surprised as to you have this inner image of what you believe this person looks like and will speak like. And it's nothing like that. So it can be very surprising and very interesting.
And what insight did you gain from the video that you didn't get from the written application? Was it presence?
You really get it's the presence of an applicant. So you really get a sense for how well can this person present themselves? You know, how are they able to put a cohesive thought, like in front of the camera when they ask, you know, they ask the question and they have a limited amount of time to prepare for it. And it's not as important as to what it is they're ultimately saying, but does it make sense? Can they present this argument? You know, it's not necessarily a question of is this argument right or wrong, but can they present a case here? And are they able to do so without getting cut off in the video? And are they deciding to wear a T-shirt and shorts? Or do they ultimately decide to, you know, wear business casual and have the right lighting? So it was incredibly insightful as to how prepared and presentable candidates are. And that also, you know, plays a big role into thinking of, do you think you have an applicant here that can actually present themselves well to recruiters?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I think we're going to see more and more video questions.
Yeah, I think so too. And I really like that.
How would you recommend somebody prepare for that?
You really, first of all, I think you really do have to prepare. Some applicants think they can wing it. I would not recommend it. I would really recommend to sit yourself down and to time yourself. And now you have all these, you know, these new tools that you can actually videotape yourself and you can look at your videotape. You should probably ask somebody to review that tape to make sure, not tape, your recording to make sure that you come across the way
you're dating
you
yourself.
Want to come across.
You're dating.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I would agree with you, but you go ahead. You were saying how you should review the video and
don't wing it. Practice. Yeah. Have somebody, have a third person, maybe even somebody who has, you know, experience in this field, review it.
Yes.
And provide you with actual feedback on.
Are you available now?
I am. We're getting more booked out, but we're available. I think the Madeline's. But I think, you know, you really, really want to practice it. A lot of candidates, I think they can wing it. And it's really, truly not a good idea.
Right. One of the things I also. Go ahead, Madeline Wing.
You want to practice it enough that you're comfortable enough in front of the camera when it's a real life situation that you can actually possibly, you know, relax a little bit, right? I mean, you know, because you want to be able to come across as personable and friendly. And if you're too tense and worried just about your answer, you're not necessarily going to be thinking about some of the softer things like, you know, are you looking at the camera? Are you maybe smiling a little bit at the end? You know, things like that, which can really help with your presentation.
Absolutely. One of the things I also recommend, and this sounds kind of silly, but I would put a smiley face somewhere where you can see it under the camera to remind you to smile, because you're going to be staring at a camera that doesn't have any affect, that doesn't encouraged. It doesn't smile. It shows absolutely zero emotion. It looks like it couldn't care less about what you're saying. And that lack of reaction, reactivity, otherness can make you seem very wooden. The first time I ever did a video for Accepted, I looked at it later and I thought, my goodness, I look almost angry. I didn't smile at all. I look so stern. And I think there is a tendency because there's nobody looking back at you. There's nobody smiling at you. There's nobody else there. So, again, I would practice it to get used to that very weird feeling. And also, in my case, whenever I do something like that, I have a smiley face or somebody smiling at me to remind me to be a little bit more natural and human.
Yeah, I mean, you can tape a picture of your best friend or something, right?
Right.
So you're actually can feel like you're talking to someone and someone who you are comfortable with, and I think that will really come across.
Right. Okay. I'm going to ask you guys for general tips in a minute, but Madeline Baker, I believe you are from Germany. Do you have any special tips for Europeans in general or specifically for people who grew up in the German educational system when they apply to business schools?
I think not necessarily, Linda. I think that outcomes really, they're so versed. They see these applications from all over the world. I think, coming from Germany, the grading and things like that, pretty straightforward. There isn't necessarily a lot of explanation needed. Most times what I see with applicants from Europe is, really help around the language in essays and having them. While they need to be authentic and there will be errors in there in terms of not English being your first language, I think applicants benefit greatly from having somebody proofread essays and help with input on recommendation letters. Not necessarily wording, but I'm talking about content and how Americans look at recommendation letters. I think that's something that applicants from Europe should really consider.
Okay, great. Thank you. Now, what tips do each of you have for applicants applying in the 2017-18 cycle? So they're either in the middle of it or they're going to very soon be in the middle of it. Madeline Wang, why don't you start?
Well, I mean, my tip would be really to get started right away if you haven't already. I think for applications, right, generally it's the first or second round. If you're looking at, early January deadlines for many schools is really, when you want to make sure you have your applications in by. And that really requires some good planning and getting started with selecting your schools, making sure that, you have your test scores completed and at a point where, you're done taking the test. So that you can really focus on your essays, on recommendations, et cetera. I think in your resume, I think it's always just best to have enough time to really be thoughtful about your application and not rush it in late December. So that means really getting started as soon as possible.
Okay, great. Madeline Baker?
Yeah, so I would add to that. I mean, obviously, I would reiterate, yes, if you haven't started, really, you need to get on it because you want to apply as early as you can, assuming that you're ready and you have the score that you want to present to the school and you have your story straight. So, start putting your application together really soon. And my other two points would be really have someone proofread your application, even if you decide not to work with a consultant throughout the process. Really find someone that can take a look at the application and avoid sloppy mistakes. Everybody knows looking at the same document over and over and really getting sort of blind as to, what's in the document and not seeing your own mistakes. There's nothing worse there are a few things worse, I think, from a reader's perspective than presenting a sloppy picture. That's not good, and you don't want to do that. And lastly, I think really before you even sit down and write anything, think about the story that you want to present to admissions. A lot of applicants, I think, forget about you know, really trying to tell a story that makes sense. And they're looking at the the individual trees, and they forget all about the forest around them. So really think about what that story is you want to tell the admissions office, and then start to sit down and write your essays.
Okay, great. Thank you. What advice do you have for applicants planning ahead for the 2018-19 cycle or later? In other words, they're not applying this application cycle. They are planning ahead, which is what we strongly recommend. Madeline Baker, you want to start with that one?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting because I just had a call with a prospective client, and we spent about an hour talking about, or I could call it a client actually, but we spent an hour talking about what the resume looks like right now and what can be done in the next year. So I think it would make a lot of sense for people to get ready and to think about what it is, what the gaps are in the resume, like where there's improvement, for example, in volunteer work or in leadership, where, you know, that can be really addressed over the next year. Or is the GMAT your weak spot and you want to spend your time working on that? Really take a step back and look at your profile and see what you can work on over the next year.
Okay. Yes, I actually was talking with a delightful young man who's planning ahead to apply. And again, it was, you know, what are some of the softer, if not weaker, points in his resume and background, and what can he do about it? And it was delightful. I mean, it was just wonderful, because he's going to hit the ground running next year, I believe, is when he plans to apply. And
yeah,
it was
that's
great.
Right, because he's going to be prepared. And
he's going to be fully
he's
prepared.
He's going to have addressed. Yeah, exactly.
He's got it all right. Together. Madeline Wang, do you have anything to add for those planning ahead?
Yeah, I think, I think all those points I would agree with. And, you know, I would say that, you know, you should also kind of think about, you know, a lot of times people might want to use the MBA as kind of a launch pad for them to, you know, to switch careers,
right,
you know, completely. And that's fine. But if you kind of know this already and you're, you know, like, you know, at least a year out from your MBA, then, or applying for your MBA, then, you know, then you might want to think about actually pre-MBA starting to move in that direction in some way. I mean, whether it's professionally or in even in a way that's kind of out in a volunteer way, just to, for the admissions committee, you know, to demonstrate that interest and that you really know what you're getting into, but also for yourself too, so that you can really be sure about the choices that you're making and be able to really articulate that you want to make a change and you have knowledge and experience that you can point to that shows that, you know, that you're ready for that change and know what it entails.
That's great advice. One last question for each of you. Is there anything, and they don't have to be the same, that you wish I wish would have asked you? Madeline Wang, you want to start with that one?
You know, I think you asked a pretty pretty comprehensive list of questions. I don't think anything jumps to mind. Anything else I'd want to add.
Okay. Sounds good. Madeline Baker.
Yeah, I don't think so either, Linda. I think you asked very good questions. So I don't really know. I can't come up with anything that I wish you would have asked me.
Okay. All right. Well, Madeline, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been delightful, and I really think you've provided some solid, solid insight here.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you would like to learn more about Madeline Baker and Madeline Wang, we'll link to their bios from our show notes at accepted.com/227. They are also available to work with you on your MBA applications. And again, you can express your interest in working with them at their bios. You can learn about our services. We'll link to those. And we'll link to other resources and recent shows that are relevant to this one. You can check it all out at accepted.com/227. Thank you for joining Madeline Baker, Madeline Wang, and me for our 227th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please subscribe. Make sure you don't miss any future shows, be they with admissions directors, wonderful consultants, professors, current students, test prep pros, or alumni doing great things. Thanks again for coming. This is Admissions Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.